when you hear that music, it means that it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. I have missed you all while I was out hearing about everything that's upcoming in television, and we'll get to that and a chat about what I saw and what you might look for. Before that, though, we'll hop into the post-apocalyptic, robot-heavy dystopia of the week in Elysium. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in Historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and that sort of thing for NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm extremely happy to see all of you.
Yay!
It's wonderful to be home.
Got the band back together.
And I want to thank Audie Cornish from last week. How fantastic was that?
Pretty great.
And also, of course, our friends Gene Demby and Kat Chow from the week before that. How great was that?
Almost as if there's no drop-off at all when Linda leaves.
It's like no one notices in the slightest. I could just take the rest of the weeks off and no one would even mind at all. I was very glad to hear how well the show went. I enjoyed listening to it. I enjoyed listening to it as a completely uninvolved participant. I judged nothing. I was just super, super happy about it. And I was very glad to hear everything going well. Anyway, this weekend we all saw, I believe, Elysium.
Yes. Correct.
Yes.
So Elysium is a movie from writer-director Neil Blomkamp, who also did District 9, a Best Picture nominee from a few years ago. That movie was about aliens and apartheid, one might say. He is a South African gentleman himself. Mm-hmm. And it was about segregating an alien population and the inevitability of that backfiring on you.
And then Elysium.
And then Elysium.
Cost three times as much money and is one-third as good.
Yeah. Why don't you, Stephen, what did you, why don't you expound a little bit on what Elysium is about?
Okay. Elysium is set on a future Earth, I believe 2154, 2159, thereabouts. I just got to get that exactly right.
Yeah.
And basically, it is set on the Earth of WALL-E, but with people.
So there you are mean giant, with real people instead of cartoon people.
Well, no, but I mean giant on Earth. It is a heavily populated Earth.
I see.
And
but it looks otherwise like the Earth in WALL-E.
It looks otherwise largely like with the stacks of cubes of garbage and whatever. And the 1%, if you will, the wealthiest of Earthlings have spirited away to a sort of space station called Elysium, which is a paradise where, among other things, they all have health care.
Yes, that did seem to be the underlying point, was the presence of good healthcare.
And so Matt Damon, as a resident of Earth, is trying to get to Elysium. The clock is ticking. He has 5 days to live. But how does he do it?
Yes. They do sort of set that conflict up in the first act.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that conflict sort of evaporated over the... it's amazing when you say the fact that this guy has 5 days to live kind of fades from importance over the rest of the movie.
Well, they gave him special pills to take to stave off the effects of the radiation poisoning, so we didn't have to worry about his deterioration.
Right.
It was kind of a love story situation.
His face falling off.
He got more aglow as the movie went along.
Yeah, yeah.
They also introduced the requisite adorable Moppet, who is also in danger, also has a health issue.
Right.
So it's not enough, apparently, that you need to root for the hero.
Right.
You need to root for the adorable Moppet as
right.
well.
Who belongs to his former friend, not ex-girlfriend.
Childhood
exactly,
friend.
Childhood friend slash sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
What I personally think is so impressive about this mishmash of story with him and the radiation poisoning and the pills and all this stuff, then all of a sudden out on this space station Elysium, where all the rich people now live, you have the petty political squabbles of the Elysian government, including the president and the defense secretary, played by Jodie Foster with an accent I absolutely could not figure out.
Okay, here's I spent some time trying to figure out what the hell Jodie Foster was doing with that accent. My theory of what they were going for is that it's supposed to be because she knows so many languages, yeah. because there are so many world languages, it is supposed to be six different accents at once.
That is extremely generous.
Yeah.
And it kind of is that. My theory was something along those lines. It's a polyglot world up there on Elysium with the rich of all continents. But my theory is that the character description she got from the director and writer is probably about a line and a half long,
yeah.
or maybe three words,
well,
like evil defense
secretary. You don't have a mustache, but twirl it.
Sure. Right. Yeah. And so she did all this character work on her own. She probably went and wrote reams of backstory for this character and got all kinds of tangled up in this internal monologue that is doing its best to fight its way
Very
out from
now.
Behind the Armani.
Well, this is the thing. She was hired for her ability to walk into and out of rooms frostily and in heels.
Yes.
Every single scene.
Which is so funny because normally that would not be her thing.
Yeah, I know. But with a frozen sort of rictus grin yeah. of a scheming quality
yeah.
just to show that she was alive. And
it has been yeah. highly entertaining watching a lot of presumably progressive-minded film writers and entertainment writers bend over backwards to point out how clunky the class war metaphors in this film are.
Okay, here's my thing. I wasn't as big a fan of District 9 as many people were. I came out of that film thinking, you know, this was a really good update of Alien Nation, the 1988 mm-hmm. film starring James Caan and Mandy Patinkin, plus some vivisection.
Plus elements of The Fly.
That's what I mean. There's a lot of gore. And the thing about it is, I think it got overrated at the time because of its use of allegory, which makes it seem a much smarter film than it actually is. Because all science fiction works in metaphor.
Sure.
Even the schlockiest shoulder hoops and headbands, zappy ray gun science fiction is a comment on today.
Sure.
But allegory is the least interesting, the most didactic form of metaphor. So it quashes characterization. It forces plot into this very schematic, although let's admit in Elysium, very weird, truncated, like all kinds of different directions and things that kind of where we spent, as you mentioned in your post, Linda, we spent a lot of time not caring about things that we should have cared about because they were set up to get to another place. I think very smart critics gave District 9 a pass because of its allegory. I think we're finally seeing when it's blown up to this extent, you can see how paper thin the thinking behind it is.
My takeaway from Elysium, which I mentioned on Twitter and was surprised at the number of people who sort of snapped to this and said, yes, I think that was my sense as well, was the fact that it's much stronger at world building than it then is at storytelling.
Yeah.
Because to me, this world of Elysium, the idea that you have this 150 years in the future LA, and then you have that the very wealthy people have essentially abandoned Earth because it's become too polluted, too environmentally disastrous to live on, and also because that way they're protected from the poor people that they have from whom they've created this massive divide of wealth. That world is interesting to me. The idea that perhaps you would have the equivalent of a deserted island that all your rich people go live on.
Yeah. A gated community in heaven.
A gated community in heaven. And the poor people still live on Earth and do the industry. And, you know, somebody was saying today, like, well, how come the missiles are shot from Earth and not from up there? And I thought, well, they would limit the amount of military they have up there. They would dump that stuff all down on Earth if it was all the same to them and they could still control it. Those, to me, are interesting worlds. What would be the effects of something like that? Would you have rebellion? How far could you go with this idea that rich people can have robots do everything for them so that there is no underclass? That's an interesting idea.
Right.
And then they start telling this story about Matt Damon, and I just got, first of all, lost. Because there's a point where he goes and talks to this guy about, I need you to send me up to Elysium so that I can get healed, I guess.
Well, they basically have tanning beds up there where you lie
Versace
down.
Versace
tanning beds where you lie down and are instantly healed. And all you have to do is walk into anyone's house. No one will be home. And you
healing
lie down
tanning
walk.
Beds.
Yeah.
And there's a little scanner that can tell whether you're a citizen or not.
Right.
But then there's a little moment where I couldn't really tell, like, was he saying he just wanted to go to Elysium and see it before he died? Was he saying he could be healed? Why exactly is the guy fastened on this idea? Like, if you download information from a rich guy's brain, you could then get his money, like, from where? And what would you do because you're not a citizen? And the plot didn't really hang together. And then you start introducing all these elements of the old girlfriend and the daughter and the guy with the samurai sword. And it just starts to feel like the whole thing is sprawling out of control.
There were a lot of disconnected threads in this movie. My biggest concern with the movie is that if you're going to make an allegory about things like environmental pollution, low wage employment,
income inequality,
illegal immigration,
healthcare,
the 1%, and universal health care, and you have built a world where perfect, infallible health care is available to the 0.0001%,
sure,
and everyone else can just die in the streets, you have to explain why that technology isn't available to everybody. Or you have a very black and white portrait of evil rich people hoarding that wealth.
I think that's a very, very good point. They do never explain why this seemingly fairly simple technology is not available. I mean, ultimately, I had the reaction to Elysium. I did not hate it. I was fairly engrossed by it. I respected the reach of the movie. I don't think it grasped what it was reaching for, but I appreciated some of the ambition of it. I actually was sort of curious enough at the end of it that the next night I watched District 9, which I had never seen, and which actually, Glenn, I liked quite a lot. I found that part of it is a comparatively very, very low-budget film, and the way the low budget is employed is very imaginative.
Yeah,
there's a cheapness to the feel of the sci-fi that I say in a good way. It feels kind of garagey to me in a way that I liked. It's not, obviously, but there's a sort of a tactile, interesting feeling to these what are basically big shrimp.
Yeah.
Being present in this community that feels really immediate.
Even though they're
in a way that the Elysium being off in the sky did not.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it was more plausible that this aliens are hovering over Johannesburg is more plausible in the way that it's set up. And I just found, particularly with District 9, especially early in the movie, I had no idea where they were going with it.
Right.
And that's very, very, very rare.
Yeah.
And I think that's one reason people responded so much to District 9.
I agree.
This feels much more formulaic.
Boy, by the time you get into the third act, for God's sake, if you don't know where they're going, you've never been to the movies in your life.
And I was impatient with it because it stayed on the planet much longer than I thought it would have. It stayed on the planet for a good hour and 15 minutes of a roughly 2-hour running time.
Yeah.
And I kept waiting for him to get on that ship and go to
Which is weird, which makes it the opposite of WALL-E.
Right.
Which falls apart as soon as they leave the planet.
Mm-hmm. I found myself liking very little touches in the film. I like the designer skin. I thought that was a smart thing that they did, where the rich people had designer skin. I liked the look of William Fichter's shuttle, which kind of looked like a Bugatti, his red sort of sweet shuttle. There's a moment in the film where a robot gets blown to smithereens, which is like, please don't make this the best scene in the film.
And then it is.
It's the best scene in the film.
Yeah,
I agree.
And the self-scooching chairs. Every chair you sit in the future automatically... because farewell the tedium of self-scooching. But let's do a thing where we put out a memo to every kid in film school right now where we say you can't make a film where the climax is somebody sitting at a keyboard tapping furiously. That is not a climax for a movie anymore.
I would also add to that a climax of the movie that culminates in two dudes wailing on each other.
Well, sure.
The climactic wailings, I'm getting really a little tired of. One more thing that I don't want to see in movies anymore. Plot points hanging on whether a character will be raped.
Yeah.
Can we just not with that? I feel like
well, that's more broadly the woman in peril kind of business, and it's very common. The way that you get the hero really super invested is you put the woman in peril, and very often, not always, but very, very often, there is a lingering sense that not only might she be killed, but she might be sexually assaulted in some way. That's a very common way of building stakes for male heroes, and I agree with you.
Gigantically tired of it.
I'm way over it.
Well, speaking of building stakes, if the master of suspense, Alfred Hitchcock, were alive today, he would not show a computer monitor with the words buffering, That would not be a source of suspense.
Yeah.
And finally, at one point in this film, the hero is handed a laptop and told to press that button. At that point, Faustino leaned over to me and said, is it the enter button? And it turned out to be
the enter button.
The enter button. Yes, in fact, it was.
Before we rag on this thing 100%, I would like to point out that some of the technical filmmaking is very nice. Man knows how to shoot a chase sequence and a fight sequence. And I really rather liked what, in her New York Times review, I liked what Manuela Dargis had to say about Matt Damon as the hero and his sort of ability to, without working very hard and without ever coming off as insincere, he's able to sort of, what does she say, convey a kind of essential decency, a moral decency, that he is able to sort of portray, quote, a strikingly contemporary ideal of what used to regularly be called the American character. And I don't think there's anything particularly American about it anymore. It's sure. just what we like to think of as good character. Sure. And this guy, when he smiles, when he looks put upon, when he registers those emotions that you want a hero to register in situations like the one he's put in yeah. this one, you really believe it. There's something about this guy as an actor that's never forced.
Sure. And one thing that did occur to me while I was watching this movie, there is a moment in this movie, and obviously we're spoiling lots of pieces of this movie.
But
this is, I think, is all given away in the trailers, too. There is a point in this movie where he's essentially implanted with a metal exoskeleton type thing.
Yeah, that's
so that then
early.
He's running around with kind of robot parts. There were moments when I looked at this with Matt Damon with his head shaved bald and his metal exoskeleton where I thought this movie would be so much more effective for me if he just looked like a dude. If he just looked like a dude, he had hair, he had a t-shirt on, he didn't have the metal exoskeleton.
Instead of like an Iron Man that somebody had built in the
garage.
And
he was, right, and I actually didn't think, you know, very often when I look at something like Iron Man, I think, oh, that suit's really cool. I didn't think the exoskeleton was that cool either. I sort of thought it was mostly distracting to look at.
Yeah.
And I kept wishing that they had just played this as like,
an everyman.
Yeah. Which is a different kind of cliche. It's not that would rescue it from being a cliche.
If he were John McClane instead of Tony Stark.
Exactly. Thank you, Thompson.
I'm kind of a genius.
And that's exactly what I'm talking about, is that John McClane diehard thing is so important that he just seems like a guy. And in fact, not to go down an entire diehard rabbit hole, but it's very important that they do things like they leave John McClane without even shoes.
Right,
right.
Right? Weaknesses, vulnerabilities. Yeah. And to me, when you pump up the hero not having vulnerabilities,
you feel like
that's the opposite of what I want to be watching.
Right. Well, yeah, they're basically building up ways to explain away what is already implausible.
And I don't want him to be a robot.
Right.
I don't want to watch a robot fight another robot.
And they're trying to have it both ways by having him suffer from radiation sickness, so he's weak, and then he has to take the pills, which are magically, you know, if one is going to make him feel a little bit better than six, will make him feel super.
And structurally,
because that's how science works.
Structurally, do you understand what I'm saying when I say it really did seem like the threat of the radiation poisoning kind of goes away and becomes unimportant, because then ultimately the final conflict is really kind of not about that. Mm. That sort of, ultimately, by the time he's at the end and he's making kind of big decisions about what he's going to do or not do,
that's not the thing that influences the choice.
That's really not the point anymore.
By that point,
and I sort of feel like, oh, so his radiation sickness is kind of irrelevant now.
Well, at that point, they're just busy shoveling on Christ metaphors.
they are.
And including a bleeding hand.
Yes, I noticed that too. And I will say that the second time I saw a woman running with a child in her arms toward some sort of medical help, I thought, okay, two in one movie with the image of the woman running toward the rich person's house might be too many. Mm-hmm. Might be one too many.
Maybe one too many.
Possibly two too many.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I liked, as I said in the post that I wrote about this, I was okay with the world building part. And I think when you build a world like Middle Earth, right, people get very wound up in the world building part, coming up with the rules for how the place works. But then you still have to, if nobody cared about the story of The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit or whatever, it wouldn't matter that they built up this. Am I right, Glenn?
Sure. No, I agree.
And so I felt like this movie spent way too much time on the world building of this allegorical space in which to tell the story, and then proceeds to tell what to me is a really boring and disjointed story.
I did think, as much as I did not, and I felt the character was sort of a pastiche of other snarling villains, the bounty hunter, road warrior-esque figure who is hunting him down, who I had no idea was played by the same actor who plays Ficus, the hero in District 9, who is frankly unrecognizable from the beginning to the end of District 9, and then is completely unrecognizable as this bounty hunter.
With the samurai sword.
With the samurai sword.
Charlton Copley.
Yeah.
Charlton Copley, thank you. That's a really good actor.
Mm-hmm. He's a very fine actor. And they give him lots of room to sort of swash and buckle and be very funny with his South African accent. And there are all sorts of little South African jokes throughout this movie, which I sort of cackled at a lot.
I like
that he's sort of doing these shout-outs to
still
a hometown boy. Well, I mean, there's one of the aircraft that the bounty hunter guy, what's his name?
Kruger,
which is a South African name. He's flying a plane that's flying the South African flag. It has some sort of buck on it. I'm not sure if it's a springbuck or a water buck or something else. But it's one of those antelope things that that the South African people occasionally point to as a sort of
things.
Yes. And there were many. Boyki is a South African diminutive for buddy, or you know, boy chick. It's a kind of that kind
Did
of word.
Did he say that?
He said boyki at least twice.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And
I mean, he's South African and so is Blomkamp. So it makes sense that that would all be in there. Right. But it's interesting that you heard that, because I would have just assumed that was character business. Do you know what I mean?
No, it's, those are all sort of real things. And it's he said lekker a couple of times, which is kind of that's great. That's rad. And that's lekker is an Afrikaans word for that's really well. I like that. You know,
Trigram, ladies and gentlemen. Trigram.
But
Trigram's
spend
got
some
layers.
Time in South Africa.
And I kind of, you know, we've been kind of ragging on this for, you know, it's sort of ham-handedness. But you got to remember, this is a guy who grew up where a mother might very well be carrying a child toward a first world medical facility.
Of course.
From something not very far away where,
but
you know,
just once per movie.
It's true. But, you know, the things that he's putting on screen will resonate very differently with the people he grew up around than they will with American audiences.
I think that's part of what I mean when I say I think the world building is promising. Mm-hmm. I think putting yourself in a space to tell a story about this massive income inequality is similar to putting yourself in a space to tell a story that was basically an apartheid story, which is what District 9 was. It's just a matter of, do you then successfully come up with things to do with these characters that hold together, that make sense, that, you know, that are coherent from beginning to end?
I just feel like this is such an imaginative filmmaker. I wish that this particular time around he'd made a better film.
Yeah. And I'm sympathetic to the position. I mean, I saw somebody tweet today, and I apologize for not remembering who it was, but that, you know, this movie is the equivalent of the Star Trek episodes where Gene Roddenberry would stop all the action to have someone stand on the bridge and lecture us about the Cold War. Yep. I think there is some of that, too. Sci-fi people tend to be people with sort of big ideas that they're trying to get their arms around. And I respect, like Trey was saying, I respect the ideas that he's trying to get his arms around. It's just a matter of, does it really work? And I think ultimately it doesn't really work. I don't hate this movie as much as some people hated it.
Yeah, I don't actually hate it at all. I think it's kind of a hot mess, but I enjoyed watching it.
I think that's a fair way to put it. I was largely engrossed throughout. I didn't sit there with my arms folded the way I've sat through things I've hated. I found it engrossing, just not successful.
Yeah. Well, you should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you think of Elysium or other allegorical films or District 9 or sci-fi or the idea of trying to get your arms around a big story in a sci-fi setting. These are all things that have come up today. Speaking of coming up today,
you've lost nothing.
I know. I am back from California. For the last 2.5 weeks, I have been sitting in a hotel in Beverly Hills at the Television Critics Association press tour, which is where the Television Critics Association, which consists of something like 125 people plus some other people who are invited by the networks, come and sit at a very, very long series of press conferences where they parade people on and off the stage to talk about various new shows, various new projects, various new things that they have coming. Sometimes they were executive sessions where the guy from HBO came and talked about the vision for HBO and where HBO is going. Sometimes they were for individual network shows like The Blacklist with James Spader, where he's like, it's basically a Silence of the Lambs ripoff that I don't understand how they don't think they're going to get nailed for the fact that it's a Silence of the Lambs ripoff, but that's okay. Anyway, and sometimes they were for more ambitious projects like Showtime brought a really interesting series they have coming up called Masters of Sex, which is about Masters and Johnson, and it stars Michael Sheen as Masters and Lizzie Kaplan as Johnson. So that's what I've been doing for the last couple weeks.
Now, you attended, if I'm not mistaken, 105 panels.
105. Now, those of you who've listened to the podcast for a while may remember that a couple years ago, I talked about the number of panels I had been to, and I think it was 80-something. Mm-hmm. And this year it was 105.
So you did, what, like 20 better? You're like a 20 better person.
Well, I don't know if better is the right word. More?
All right, stupidest panel.
Okay, there would be two that I would put up as stupidest panel. The first one, more of you will have read about. There was and Glenn will have read about this one as well. There was a panel right near the end for a PBS documentary about superheroes where there were several guys who are comic creators who, at the very end of the panel, my friend Alyssa Rosenberg, who works for Think Progress in the Atlantic and some other places, asked some fairly I thought, easy questions about, is the industry a little bit stuck because there's not much representation of women and minorities and LGBT people in superhero comics? And they kind of gave a whole parade of frustrating answers. And, you know, a couple of these guys, as comics writer Gail Simone pointed out later, a couple of these guys, including Jerry Conway and
Len Wein.
Are guys who have created terrific female characters, sure. And she considers them allies. But on this particular day, what came out was a bunch of stuff about, well, if it's all about a message, then everybody gets bored. And, yes. You know, and of course, the other person on the panel was Todd McFarlane.
Yeah, you can't lump these two guys in with Todd McFarlane. Todd McFarlane is his own guy.
But the thing is, there wasn't a good distinction between, you would not have walked out of that panel and said, that's the guy who's really bad on these issues, and these are the guys who are really strong on these issues. It was a panel that I think the discussion just didn't go the way you would have hoped. So in a way, it's a bad panel in the sense that I think they just didn't get at what they were trying to get at.
Right.
And they wound up making it sound like they just absolutely didn't care. There was some comment about trying to have female superheroes is like trying to have female medieval knights, like, because they didn't really exist. And it was like,
No, Jerry Conway went on Twitter after that to kind of say, look, I screwed up in my answers. I wasn't prepared for this. You know, we were talking about superheroes as myth, and I would say something better if I had it to do over
again. And I was glad he said that. And Alyssa tweeted that. And I think everybody's been really happy to hear him say that.
There is something to the fact that the superhero genre is a regressive genre. It is steeped in nostalgia. It is born out of nostalgia. So it looks backwards. And there are great female creators writing about female characters in the superhero genre, even in the mainstream superhero genre. But the fact that I can tick them off on my hand means that there's not that many of them. So, I mean, a book by Kelly Sue DeConnick, Captain Marvel is great. Gail Simone is doing Batgirl and Red Sonja. Superhero Girl by Faith Erin Hicks is not mainstream necessarily, but it's a great book.
And that's the one that Jerry Conway said, that's the only superhero comic that my daughter will read is the Faith Erin Hicks because it's a woman.
Right.
The thing that was interesting was this was a really good example of a panel that sort of goes in a weird direction because I think people are not, they've just come from Comic-Con.
Right.
So they're thinking differently from this panel, right? This is a group of journalists who the rest of the stuff that they're seeing that day is other PBS stuff, not other comics stuff. As it happens, Alyssa's pretty knowledgeable about comics, but my theory now, in retrospect, is that specifically Len Wein and Jerry Conway answered those questions thinking that they were answering them kind of against the backdrop of all the work that they've done.
Right.
So they were sort of thinking, like, everyone knows that I've done X, Y, Z. And given that you know that I did that, my answer would be A, B, and C.
Right.
And there was no sort of context for it in the sense of like, yes, absolutely, this is a valid question. I think it was just it was not a good discussion. And I think that I was really glad the questions got answered. And I hope they get answered again. But I was glad he clarified as
right.
well.
That's great.
So that was one.
And then, you know, that was over. And then you got to go see the panel about the show that I think you're probably most excited about this fall season, right? It's Dads.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah. The Dads, I'm assuming, panel. This is the other stupid one.
Yeah. The Dads. Okay. Dads is a show that's coming to Fox. It is executive produced by Seth MacFarlane. He didn't create it, but he's one of the EPs. It stars Seth Green and Giovanni Ribisi and Martin Mull and Peter Riegert. And what you have is two sons and two fathers. And basically all four of the guys are, to greater or lesser degrees, kind of racist. And it's like, it's sort of supposed to be like that the dads are more racist and the sons are kind of like accidentally racist. Being racist is not the only thing they are on the show.
They're also misogynist,
like,
right?
There's also farting and, you know, other like things or whatever.
They've got layers.
The thing that was attracting the most attention on the panel was some racial humor in the pilot that involves, among other things, there's an actress, Brenda Song, who's an Asian actress, who winds up in this scene where they make her dress up like a manga character to sort of charm this Asian businessman into making a deal with them. And it's really problematic. So we get into this panel and, you know, you ask these guys these questions. And in the morning on that press tour day, you had the executive session, which is where Kevin Reilly, who's like the executive from Fox, comes and talks about kind of the overview, things happening at Fox, answers questions about all different shows, his executive view of how things are going. And somebody asked him about Dads and this kind of problematic humor on Dads. And he basically disowned the pilot a little bit. He sort of said, I think the pilot is one thing. The humor will be calibrated a little bit differently as we go forward and so forth.
We'll dial down the racism.
I asked when we got to the panel with the creators, I said, Kevin Reilly,